number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to figure out how we can all celebrate a great event. What is that great event? The end of the pandemic. The end of COVID-19 interfering with our life, with our economy, with our politics, with the way we actually enjoy every precious day that we have. Nobody better to speak to about that than my two guests for coming up. Dr. Ettore Palazzo, who is the Chief Medical and Quality Officer at Evergreen Health in Kirkland, Washington, and Dr. Francis Rito, who is Medical Director for Infectious Disease at Evergreen Health. They have both received a great deal of national exposure, answering questions, appearing in documentaries and in TV reports because of their extremely deep experience now in dealing with the virus. I think Evergreen Health was the first hospital to actually treat a COVID-19 patient. Is that right, Dr. Palazzo?
So actually, we're second in line, really. Providence Everett up in Snohomish County had the first case in January. It was just that next month where that large community outbreak near us surfaced, and we were then off to the races as well.
Okay, speaking of off to the races, we were winding down and moving in the right direction, according to most reports. Where do we stand now? Has there been a significant outbreak that you can notice because of this new Delta variant?
Well, first off, Michael, thank you for having us again. It's good to be with you. And unfortunately, we are seeing cases rise again nationally. Since the middle part of June, where cases had consistently been decreasing up until that point, we've now seen a steady rise again, which we do believe is multifactorial. The Delta variant, which now is the primary variant that in most recent testing has been identified, is clearly more infectious. Of course, all across the country, there's increased reopening, and we have vaccine hesitancy and resistance, which we know is effective against this variant and others, which I think is explaining the rise in cases.
Well, in terms of the rise in cases, let me ask you this. I was asking about how we can ever come to that day when we can say, okay, the pandemic is behind us. We're now just dealing with normal medical needs. Is there a way, can vaccines actually help us put an end to this emergency?
Oh, hi, Mike. Michael, this is Frank Rito, and thanks again for having us. So the answer to getting off this roller coaster of these surges one after another is immunity. And there are two pathways to immunity. One is to get naturally infected, and we know that provides some level of immunity for some period of time. It's not perfect, and it's not quite as strong or as durable as vaccine-induced immunity. And the second pathway is vaccine. Now, we've all seen the effect of taking the infection pathway, and that's over 600,000 people dead in the United States, and the number is probably closer to 800,000. Untold misery, morbidity, long hospital stays, untold billions of dollars of health care costs. The alternative pathway is vaccination, and we've seen that pathway too. And you see already dramatic decreases in mortality associated with those who've been immunized, decreased rates of hospitalization and illness. Even if you are infected with the virus, they tend to be much more mild. We also anticipate going down the road that many of us who have been vaccinated will get disease, will get infected, but it's going to be a much milder form. And I think that's going to be the status quo going ahead. Vaccinated people, mild disease. Unvaccinated people, severe illness, hospitalization, and a very marked increased risk of death.
Okay, this is very, very important because I have been deluged by emails and calls and letters from people who still distrust the vaccine. Let me give you a sample and maybe you can help to respond. This came in from Joan in Silverdale, Washington. She says the reason people don't like these vaccines is because they're not natural. They're synthetic, just like GMOs. The polio vaccine pretty much wiped out polio because it was a real vaccine. This vaccine is not a real vaccine. They haven't even isolated the COVID gene. After two shots, you still have to wear a mask. It's ridiculous. Your response for Joan?
Well, this is a real vaccine. The genetic material is a copy of the sequence of the messenger RNA that's taken from one of the original viral isolates. It is a real genetic sequence, and that sequence codes the protein synthesis. It makes the spike protein inside your cells, which your body then recognizes as a foreign protein and develops antibodies against it. This is a very similar model to other vaccines that we use. For example, the shingles vaccine just takes a protein from the outer coat and your body makes antibodies to it. The reason there are lipids in this vaccine is to get that protein inside the cell. Without it, nothing would happen. So these are vaccines. I'm not sure that any vaccine is natural. You're not going to go out and find them in nature unless you use the concept of a virus as your vaccinator. And if you want to get immunized or naturally infected in order to develop antibodies, you can approach it that way. That's the infection route. That's, quote, the natural route, but it's going to be a tough road with a lot of morbidity, a lot of suffering, and a lot of death. It's not the most efficient way to do it.
What about this idea that people are saying the vaccines don't work because look at all of the vaccinated people, like there are 50 runaway Democrats that people have been paying attention to who left Austin, Texas and came to Washington, D.C., and boom, they've had a super spreader caucus of, I think they have at least six people who have COVID-19 now. They supposedly have mild systems. And why hasn't the vaccination worked for them and for others who have even called in and said, oh, I got doubly vaccinated, got both vaccines, and I still got COVID? Why does that happen?
I think it's helpful to consider vaccine like a seatbelt in a car. A seatbelt does not prevent a car accident. A seatbelt prevents serious injury, hospitalization, and death if you get in a car accident. And a vaccine is exactly the same thing. This will not prevent you from getting infected. It will make it more likely that you have a completely asymptomatic infection. It'll keep you out of the hospital, keep you off a ventilator, and keep you from dying of COVID-19. It's the best analogy I can come up with because I think we all understand and we all get in the cars, drive, understanding that 100 people die every day in car accidents. And yet when you look, there's a significant proportion of those individuals who have been saved by a seatbelt. It's just that simple. You cannot
Let me ask you this, because a lot of people say, and it's shocking to me. There are literally dozens of letters that have come into me saying that the vaccine is more dangerous than the virus. And after the break, if we can approach that, I want to also approach a claim yesterday by a radio talk show host. That more than a million people, he says 1.2 million people have been killed by the vaccine. Is there any basis at all for believing that? What are the real dangers or fatality rates involved with getting these vaccines? We will be right back and so much appreciate your conversation and your information. Dr. Frank Rito and Dr. Ettore Palazzo of Evergreen Health, 1-800-955-1776, our phone number.
Become a MedHead member today.
Michael, my wife and I are MedHead members, and we've listened to you for years.
Commercial-free podcasts, commentaries, find out more at michaelmedved.com.
For our guests, Dr. Palazzo and Dr. Rito of Evergreen Health, the Chief Medical and Quality Officer and the Medical Director for Infectious Diseases, this question of vaccines and COVID outbreaks and variants and helping people live and get well, this is not an abstraction. It's every day. It's real. It's a vocation. And I appreciate them taking some time off for to talk to us. Let me ask you this. Do you have, of the COVID patients that you have right now at Evergreen, is it follow the national pattern that the overwhelming majority of them who actually end up in the hospital are unvaccinated?
Yeah, Michael, this is Atori. That is absolutely our experience here at Evergreen, and you know, data that's supported and provided to us by the Department of Health also very clearly is mapping out the risk threshold or difference, I should say, for those hospitalized with and without vaccine. And depending on what time and through what wave we're looking at, we're talking on the order of 20-fold increased risk for hospitalization without vaccine. Almost universally, the COVID patients that we're seeing in the hospital now are unvaccinated.
Okay, based upon a statement on public airways yesterday, is there any possibility, as one host maintained, that 1.2 million people could have died from receiving the vaccine?
So, Michael, I just simply, without, you know, the data to support that, just, you know, do not believe that to be the case. And the reason I say that is, you know, we know through the mechanisms that exist through the CDC to report adverse events with any severity that are taken very, very seriously by the vaccine providers and those that are caring for COVID patients and those that come in with possible vaccine side effects, that the data just simply do not support that figure.
Right. The figure is closer to about 5,000 total, not 1.2 million. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not even aware that many individuals have actually died of vaccine. So there are some increased risks with certain vaccines. Very small numbers. Guillain-Barré with one of the vaccines, myocarditis, blood clotting. But when you look at the risks associated with infection, the risk for blood clotting disorders with COVID infection is 10 times greater than the risk. A small number of individuals that have been seen with vaccines. So it's a proportionate response, and I think you have to look at it in the context of what's going on in the community, what the background rate of all these diseases are. For example, what's the natural rate of Guillain-Barré syndrome, and then see if those individuals who've been vaccinated have higher rates. Otherwise, it's very difficult to sort out any question, and you can't just attribute a side effect to the vaccine because it happened at the same time. It's just as likely that it was a coincidence, and that's why these very large collections of data are examined carefully by CDC and the FDA and other agencies to make sure that we're not missing a signal that might warn us of a potential complication.
Just on a human basis, I was reading yesterday to the audience a posting by a physician in Alabama who had spoken to some patients during the last stages of their illness before they passed, who were deeply regretting that they had not gotten vaccines, that they had been unvaccinated. In a human interaction, do you ever hear regret from people who are hospitalized with COVID?
Indeed, we do. And as the chief medical officer, I have an administrative role here at Evergreen, but do get to continue to see patients. And that is the exact story of the last COVID patient that I was assisting with caring for in the critical care unit. And it was a very sad moment for this individual who is critically ill and their family who could not visit them because of what was going on. And all across the continuum of this individual, individuals, you know, care support network, that was the theme. And it's so hard as a provider working to help them get better and knowing that there was a path that was different than the one that they were on, and them now realizing that as well.
I hope that people take that to heart. What is your best guess as the way that some of the people who are vaccine hesitant, the most important argument to make to them about actually getting vaccinated and protecting themselves and the community?
There are a number of approaches that you can take, and this has been looked at carefully. I think the strongest argument you can make beyond just protecting yourself and the ability of you to make a livelihood is to look at what would happen if you were laid up for weeks or months, or if you died. And, you know, there's 600,000 documented deaths in this country. Every one of those families has been profoundly affected by the loss of that individual. And, you know, we see other people who are in critical care for weeks to months and rehab facilities for weeks to months afterwards, severely disrupting family lives. And it turns out that one of the most persuasive arguments for an individual to get vaccinated comes not necessarily from a political figure or a sports star, or sometimes not even their doctor. It turns out that family members are the most persuasive in terms of getting people vaccinated. So I would tell your listeners, if you have a family member that's not vaccinated, reach out to them quietly, calmly, and just say, you know, please do this. If not for yourself, do it for other members in your family. Do it for your parents. Do it for your children. Just look at the consequences of what might happen if you become severely ill. Nobody counts on dying. It's just what might happen in a severe case, let alone all the suffering that goes along with it. I think you have to do it calmly and quietly, otherwise you're not going to make any headway. And I think this approach often will work. The vaccine continues to be available. Tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people now vaccinated, billions of vaccine doses around the world. We know that this is a safe vaccine. We know it's extraordinarily effective. 99.2% of the people that died of COVID between mid-May and end of June, 99.2% not vaccinated. I mean, I think every one of those individuals would like a do-over, but it's too late. Don't make it too late for yourself.
Or for your family. This is so important. I mean, what we talk about on the air, we try to talk about stuff that matters, but this is literally life and death. And really, it's the only hope that we have of putting an end to this nightmarish episode in American history of the pandemic. Thank you for your efforts, and God bless you with continued success for them. Dr. Ettore Palazzo, Chief Medical and Quality Officer, Evergreen Health, and Dr. Francis Rito, Medical Director for Infectious Disease at Evergreen Health. Godspeed to both of you.
The Michael Medved Show.
It's powerful and inspiring.
I'm so proud to be able to actually be one of the sources that you can get good and solid and true information, however popular or unpopular it may be, concerning the pandemic. It's one of the reasons I get up and I'm proud to do my work every morning and every afternoon. And look, this is one of those things where people who want to downplay it and are just tired of COVID-19, believe me, I'm really, really tired of it. And so are you. And in terms of recognizing that this is not just a little blip on the screen, this is the CDC director who, by the way, I understand she's a new CDC director. She's a Biden appointee. But she is universally respected and appears to have no partisan bone in her body. She's trying to do a job to keep Americans healthy. Her name is Rochelle Walensky. She spoke today about what is going on with the Delta variant. Listen.
The Delta variant is more aggressive and much more transmissible than previously circulating strains. It is one of the most infectious respiratory viruses we know of and that I have seen in my 20-year career.
Okay, 20 years is a long time. This is not just the Kung flu, as people say. It's not being manipulated by the government for any nefarious purpose. This is one of those things where people say, well, what business is it of the government? If I want to get a vaccine, that's fine. If I don't want to get a vaccine, it's not the government's business. Does anybody question today what lots of people questioned in the past, which is how deadly smoking is? I mean, smoking is a terrible, terrible addiction. And it is. And it's a terrible habit that kills 500,000 people every year, more, and kills them with horrible deaths. And okay, does anyone doubt that at this point? And the government, it seems to me, has played a very constructive role in this. Conservatives don't believe that the government fails every time. Sometimes the government can change humanity in a positive way. Government abolished slavery. It was a federal initiative initially and backed initially by all kinds of private individuals and trying to change society. And in terms of smoking, back in 1950, an estimated one half of American adults smoked regularly and smoked heavily. Half! And today, it's less than 13% of American adults smoke. That's a huge change. It's still too many. The government played a role in that. Adjusting tax policy, that's not the best way to do it. But you remember there were lots and lots of anti-smoking campaigns, some done charitably and some done by the government. Is the government right to do that? To try to protect people from secondhand smoke, which, yes, does have some effect, not the same effect as getting a pack yourself, but it can cause damage to people. And the idea that conservatives, of all people who should be pro-life, we're all pro-life, right? That we would hesitate about saving lives? CBS News did an interview with a hospitalized patient with COVID and asked him about his regrets, if any, about the vaccine. This is clip three. Listen.
Here I am recovering, getting out of here finally tomorrow. Am I going to get a vaccine? No.
Why not?
Because there's too many issues with these vaccines.
This father, former baseball coach, small business owner, and hunter, caught COVID, and then he developed pneumonia.
Before you got sick, if you would have had a chance to get the vaccine and prevent this, would you have taken the vaccine? Nope. So you'd have gone through this?
I'd have gone through this, yes, sir. Don't shove it down my throat. That's what's local, state, federal administration is trying to do, is shove it down your throat.
What are they shoving, the science?
No, they're shoving the fact that that's their agenda. The agenda is to get you vaccinated.
Their agenda is to keep people alive and to keep society functioning without breakdowns or lockdowns. There was another interview of another man in the hospital who said this. This is clip four.
P.J. Perry says he and most of his family had refused to get the COVID vaccine.
Where have you gotten most of your news from regarding the vaccine?
It's on Facebook and, you know, people sending you stuff.
Now, this 48-year-old father says as soon as he leaves this hospital, he is getting vaccinated.
I don't care if anybody is mad at me. that say I want to take it, I don't care anymore. I don't want to feel like this.
I think Americans in general are tired of feeling like this. Why would anyone be angry at someone for taking a vaccine? What sense does that make? I've gotten several items here in terms of emails. People saying that I'm falling for propaganda that says that Republicans are more likely to resist vaccines than Democrats. People saying actually, and by the way, this is true. The two groups that are most identified as being vaccine hesitant are Republicans, conservatives, and also African Americans, black people. And they aren't usually, most black people aren't Republican, and most Republican aren't black. But among those two groups, it's vastly more common, and they have pretty good numbers, and they're not numbers from any political polling operation. They're numbers from Kaiser Health program, which monitors these things, that over half of self-identified Democrats have been doubly vaccinated now. And it's just about half of Americans in general. With Republicans, the numbers are about a quarter. And so it's not, you know, the completely opposite or total difference, but a very dramatic difference. In other words, Democrats are about twice as likely to have received two vaccinations and to have the most protection you can have than Republicans are. This is a competition that we ought to win. We ought to win a bunch of congressional races. We ought to win a bunch of governor's races. But we ought to win the competition in showing that we actually can encounter and prevail over what is a harsh reality. And by the way, anyone will tell you, the vaccine takes a moment. It's now easy to get. It's free. And you will be doing yourself and everybody you know a favor. Even here in the state of Washington, there are still more than a third of the state, I believe it is, that has still not received the double vaccine, both vaccines. So go for it. When we come back, there is another pandemic that is occurring, particularly afflicting teenagers. And this according to extremely persuasive and alarming medical data. It's not a pandemic that involves a virus. Well, at least not a virus as conventionally defined. What is it? We will give you the answer coming right up on the MedVed Show.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved Show. There is a pandemic going on, and it's verified by a new study. It's reported in the Washington Post. There's a piece by Tara Barampour. The headline, teens around the world are lonelier than a decade ago. Their reason may be? Well, we'll tell you. Loneliness among adolescents around the globe has skyrocketed since one decade ago. In 36 out of 37 countries, by the way, this is a study for the Journal of Adolescence, which is a worldwide publication, part of the Program for International Student Assessment. It's a survey of over 1 million 15 and 16-year-old students. The survey included a six-item measure of loneliness at school in 2000 and right through last year. And here's what they found. It included a six-item measure of loneliness at school, and it found that nearly double the number of teens, percentage of teens, displayed high, elevated levels of school loneliness, an established predictor of depression and mental health crises. The study did not cover the period of the coronavirus pandemic, which also may have additionally affected teen well-being. In any event, Gene Twenge, who has been on this issue of teen loneliness and teen isolation for a long time, she's a professor at San Diego State. She was one of the study's lead authors. She said it's surprising that the trend would be so similar in so many different countries. On the other hand, if this trend is caused by smartphones or electronic communication, a worldwide increase is exactly what you would expect to see. In an earlier study, Twenge had identified 2012 as the year when smartphone ownership passed 50% in the United States. Before 2012, loneliness and depression had been unchanged or down for decades, unchanged among teenagers. But suddenly, in the early 2010s, loneliness, depression, and self-harm among teens, including suicide, suddenly increased dramatically in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. In the worldwide study, school loneliness was not correlated with factors such as income inequality, gross domestic product, family size, but it did correlate with increases in smartphone and internet usage. By 2012, most of the countries in the study had reached a point where at least half of teens had access to smartphones, and that is when teen loneliness levels began to soar. As smartphone adoption spread in the 2010s, adolescents spent less time interacting in person and more time using digital media. Given that digital media do not produce as much emotional closeness as in-person interaction, the result may be more loneliness in recent years, so said Gene Twenge. Social media can create an exclusionary environment that increases school loneliness, especially for girls. And they talk in this summary about just an image that probably most of us have seen, which is when a teenager is engaged in a conversation or some kind of personal meeting, and all of a sudden takes out a phone and starts concentrating on the phone. There is even a name for this, fubbing, which I didn't know. That means ignoring someone to look at your phone. While the increase in loneliness was consistent across the economic and political spectrum, there were some differences across cultures. The largest increases in loneliness indicators were in Slavic, Baltic, English-speaking, and Latin American countries. The smallest increases were in East Asian countries. The only country in the study that did not show an uptick in adolescent loneliness was South Korea. And they speculate that that's because smartphone use became widespread there before 2012. Remember, 36 of 37 countries, all these countries except for South Korea, saw indicators in problematic and damaging and, in fact, dangerous loneliness. It's really just a subgroup of kids. Maybe one in five or two in five. We should look at that group, the subset of kids who actually need our attention, rather than treating adolescents as a monolith. Okay, that's always a good idea, and that's one of the summaries here in the study. Some are taking action on the local or national level. In 2018, France stopped allowing smartphones at school. That's for both elementary and middle schools. And then they cite in this Washington Post article, Bellevue Christian School in Clyde Hill, Washington, forbids 7th and 8th graders from using their phones at school. Good for them. Teachers, parents, and even students have been grateful for the break, said Blake DeYoung, who was principal when that rule went into effect. There was a gratitude and almost a relief in their response, said former principal DeYoung. Socially, for a 14-year-old, I can't put this thing away. I can't opt out on my own. But if everybody around me has put it away, it gets easier, he said. Since limiting smartphones, there's been a decline in disciplinary problems, DeYoung said. And the lunchroom and hallways sound like a throwback, he said. It's surprising how normalized the insular student has become, head down, looking at the phone. When you see them without that, interacting in the lunchroom, it's really different. That's good to hear. And it's something worth considering, because part of the general sense that people have that things are getting worse in the United States, for instance, this Gallup poll that says that people give the lowest rating to race relations ever measured, and they've been doing this since 2000, the same questions. And right now people think race relations are terrible. Part of the reason people look at a decline in relations is because there is less normal social interaction. And this is both a reason that church attendance seems to be down somewhat, and it's also a cause that it's down somewhat, is that isolation is something that we need to pierce. And one could even say that some of the difficulty we have in reaching people to get them to come in and get vaccinated, it's people who feel isolated, who feel distrustful, who think that authority somehow is not a necessity, but in fact some kind of dire threat. All of these things are going to be exacerbated, not just for teens, but for adults, with hours and hours and hours and hours spent on the internet or in social media in other ways. When we come back, Joe Biden had a great big town meeting sponsored by CNN last night, and he spoke about the economy, and he spoke about crime. He spoke briefly about this ongoing controversy about investigating the January 6th episode. What's going to happen with that? President Trump actually has some new comments about that, just publicized, just broadcast. We'll play some of those comments for you. They actually were made by President Trump March 31st for a new book in an interview they granted. The book is called I Alone Can Fix, and we will get to that also on the Medved Show. We will also talk about the idea that the American people may be turning against unlimited spending, and that the Democratic assumption that somehow the overwhelming majority of Americans will vote for them because they're spending more, that may be entirely wrong. And a member of a city council uses the N-word to refer to one of his colleagues, and is defending himself on that issue, plus more in terms of crafting the right midterm message and developments in campaigning, and maybe indications of some Republican unity. We will get to that and more, all coming up in this greatest nation on God's green earth.